Dancing Devil Range, W.C. Tuttle, the Project Gutenberg ebook of Dancing Devil Range. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg license included with this ebook or online at www.gutenberg.org. If you are not located in the United States, you will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook. Title: Dancing Devil Range, author: W.C. Tuttle, illustrator: Kuhlhoff. Release date: May 9, 2025. Ebook 76049. Language: English. Original publication: New York, NY, Short Stories, Inc., 1948. Other information and formats: www.gutenberg.org/ebook/76049. Credits: Roger Frank and Sue Clark. Asterisk: Start of the project. GUTMBRG EBOOK Dancing Devil Range. Asterisk: Frontispiece: Dancing Devil Range by W.C. Tuttle. Hashnef was exactly the size and shape to play Santa Claus. Still, and all, peace on earth was a long way from Dancing Devil Valley that particular season. Guilty-looking man carrying a briefcase. A long, dusty freight train rattled and clanked through the desert hills, seemingly in no hurry to anywhere. Outside, it was almost dark, and there were no lights inside the caboose, where Hashknife Hartley sprawled on an uncomfortable seat and gazed wearily through a dusty window. Across the aisle was Hashknife's partner, Sleepy Stevens, stretched out on the seat, his head pillowed on his war sack. Hashknife was inches over 6 feet tall, of slender, steel-muscled manhood, his sombrero pulled low over his gray eyes. Sleepy Stevens was less than 6 feet tall, broad of shoulder and beam, slightly bow-legged. Sleepy had a grin-wrinkled face, wide mouth, and innocent-looking blue eyes which seemed amazed at the world. In garb, they were merely a pair of drifting cowboys, well-worn Stetsons, colorless shirts, stringy vests, little more than a depository for tobacco and papers, faded overalls, and high-heel boots. There was nothing fancy about these two cowpokes. Their gun belts were homemade, form-fitted by wear, and even their Colt guns, tucked into short holsters, had plain wooden butts blackened by wear. A sleepy-eyed brakeman climbed down from the cupola and wiped a grimy forearm across his dusty eyes and lighted his lantern. He said, "We're pullin' into Northgate, boys." Sleepy swung around on the seat, yawned widely, and picked up his war sack. The train was slowing down as they came out on the platform. Each one of them picked up a heavy saddle and stepped down. There were few lights in Northgate, the railroad point for all of the Dancing Devil Range. There were huge loading corrals along the tracks, indicating that much livestock was shipped from Northgate. The train stopped, with the caboose close to the depot, and the two men swung down. The conductor crossed in front of them, going into the depot, where a kerosene lamp yellow-lighted the windows. A man came from the near corner of the depot, walking swiftly toward the rear platform of the caboose. He had just reached the steps and was about to enter the caboose when a shotgun blasted from down behind the loading platform. The man twisted around, tried to grasp the doorway, but missed and went backwards off the platform, falling in the middle of the tracks behind the caboose. Hashknife and Sleepy dropped their impedimenta and ran over to the caboose. There was no sign of the shooter. The conductor, depot agent, and a brakeman came running. They picked the man up and placed him on the platform while Hashknife told them where the shot came from. There was no one in sight. The victim had stopped a dozen buckshot and was beyond any medical assistance. There was no law officer in Northgate, the sheriff's office being at Tomahawk Flats, 30 miles south, center of the Dancing Devil Range. Someone summoned a doctor and other curious people arrived. A cowboy said, "I know who he is, he's Orrin Blakely. I think he worked for the Circle H down at Tomahawk Flats." Hashknife and Sleepy secured a room at a little hotel and, after considerable haggling, bought two horses from the man who owned the livery stable and feed corral. They told him they were leaving for Tomahawk Flats in the morning. He said, "If you're looking for work down there." "What about it?" asked Hashknife quickly. "I just meant that they probably ain't looking for cowpokes. You see, the bank went busted, and that busted most of the cowmen, mackin' things kinda bad down there. If a feller was looking for work, but that's your business." "Much obliged," said Hashknife, but he didn't say whether it was for the advice or the information. Over at the hotel, they heard a man say that they had sent for the sheriff and the coroner. Another man said, "It ain't going to be a very Merry Christmas down there this year." In their little room, Hashknife sprawled on the bed, smoking a cigarette, while Sleepy looked moodily from a dusty window. Sleepy said, "I just hope we ain't playing Sandy Claus for Bob Marsh." Hashknife laughed shortly. Where'd you get that idea? Sleepy sat down and began manufacturing a cigarette. Distrust of Bob Marsh, he replied. Bob sits there at his desk, his big brown eyes as full of honesty as a coyote pup is full of fleas, and explains that all on earth he wants us to do is come down here, get the best possible price on 3-4 cattle spreads, and let him know. Well, suggested Hashknife curiously. That's all we've got to do, sighed Sleepy. No rustlers, no horse thieves, just a couple real estate men on horseback. Sounds all right to me, said Hashknife. We get paid so much for the job, and if the deals go through, we get more money. It's an honest job, Sleepy. Bob Marsh, as secretary of the Cattlemen's Association, can't afford to be mixed up in a crooked deal. Yeah, I know, but, well, a man was murdered tonight. Men, remarked Hashknife quietly, are murdered every day. Yeah, I know, but you heard that man at the livery stable saying that everybody in the dancin' devil country are broke. The bank went busted. Are you looking for boogers, Sleepy? No, I'm trying to figure out why Bob Marsh got us down here. If he can't get us into trouble one way, he'll, well, all right. I've just thought of something else, said Hashknife soberly. Sleepy looked sharply at him and said, yeah, what? It ain't long until Christmas, partner. I heard that mentioned tonight, high pockets. Christmas, heat and dust. Yeah, no, I'd like to spend a Christmas in the snow again, Hashknife. It ain't Christmas down here except on the calendar. We had real Christmases in Idaho. We had 'em in Montana too, said Hashknife. My old man, Bane Arrange, preacher, was strong for things like that. I remember the church trees, decorated with popcorn in strings, popcorn balls, and little red sacks. Of mosquito net, full of hard candy with a tired-looking orange in the bottom. They'd read telegrams from Santa Claus showing that he was common and then he'd come all in a bearskin coat, sleigh bells, whiskers. Bring in a pair of skates for little Hashknife, suggested Sleepy. They called me Henry, smiled Hashknife, but I never got any skates. A range preacher didn't make money enough and we had a whopper of a family. We was poor folks, Sleepy. Poor folks in Tomahawk Flats, too, they say. Be a bad Christmas down there, and we're going down to try and buy him out as cheap as possible. Hashknife nodded slowly. That's life, Sleepy. It's a tough life for busted folks. Ya know, Sleepy began rolling a cigarette, I'll bet ya a dollar again a donut that we don't buy any spreads. Anything to base that bet on. Bob Marsh. Listen, tall feller, Bob Marsh used that as an excuse or my original name ain't Stevens. He wanted us to come here and let nature take her course. You can't fool me, feller, I'm wise to Bob Marsh. No, I don't say that Bob's crooked, but he's a lose been a connivin' critter. He told the idea as straight as a string, Sleepy. And here we are, added Sleepy. We get off the train and what happens? A man is blasted down with a load of buckshot, that's what happened. He poked cows for one of them poverty-stricken outfits at Tomahawk Flats. Hashknife grinned. A coincidence, Sleepy. Probably a grudge between two men nothing to do with us. No, nothing tea do with us, says he. Huh, and your long nose has been wigglin' and sniffin' like the nose of a bloodhound ever since that. Poor devil done a hooligan off the end of that caboose. Nothing to do with us, eh? Let's go to bed before you get me all riled up. Hashknife laughed. It was like Sleepy to complain of things that might happen. They had been together a long time, these two drifting cowboys, always trying to find out what was going on over the next hill, only working long enough to suffice for their few wants and then going on, always looking, helping some underdog, asking nothing for themselves. Hashknife, with his ability to solve range mysteries, could have sold his services to the law and made money, but neither law nor money meant anything to them. They had seen the law miscarry too often. They loved justice, which is not necessarily law. At rare times they worked for the Cattlemen's Association, asking only that they be given a free hand and not be hampered by rules, but neither of them enjoyed nor appreciated the work. Bob Marsh would have almost given his right hand to have them work for his organization. In fact, he used every sort of ruse to get them on certain jobs, knowing that Hashknife, confronted by a problem, would never give up until it was solved. That was why Sleepy mistrusted Bob Marsh's casual suggestion that they make some money for themselves, by asking prices on some cattle ranches. They found the depot agent in the little restaurant next morning, eating breakfast with Nick McGarvin, the sheriff, and his deputy, Frenchie Arnett. The agent recognized them and told the sheriff that these were the two men who had just arrived on the freight train and were present when Orrin Blakely was shot. Hashknife introduced himself and Sleepy and sat down at their table. He was unable to tell them any more than they already knew about the shooting. Nick McGarvin was a big, two-fisted sort of person, and Hashknife mentally listed him as a much better man with his fists or gun than with his brains. Frenchie Arnett was small, dark, hatchet-faced, with a sour disposition and need of sleep. The agent went back to the depot, and the sheriff remarked, "You two came in on the freight, pack in saddles, bought two broncs from the feed corral, and said you was headin' for Tomahawk Flats tomorrow morning. That bane today?" "The corral man told ya," said Hashknife. "Did he also tell ya what else we said?" "No, he didn't. What else did ya say?" "I don't remember," replied Hashknife. "It was probably just as important as what he told ya." The sheriff nodded, but Frenchie grinned and looked sideways at the sheriff. Frenchie said, "It's a lose, best to write it out. Things like that require study." "What are you talking about?" asked the sheriff. "Nothing, Nick. Tells us some more about us," suggested Sleepy soberly. "It's sure interesting." "We don't know any more," replied the sheriff. "It's my duty to know things." "You mean finding out about everybody's deep, dark past?" asked Sleepy. "Askin," corrected Frenchie. "Nick's good at it." "Any idea who shot the man, sheriff?" asked Hashknife. "No. He's worked for the Circle H for over a year, and I ain't never knowed him to have trouble with anybody. Course, I'll have to check up with Sam Hack. He owns the Circle H. Sam might know who Oren was feudin' with, I dunno." They finished breakfast, and Hashknife and Sleepy decided to ride to Tomahawk Flats with the two officers who had so far failed to find out why Hashknife and Sleepy were going there. As they were saddling at the livery stable, a rider on a very tired horse swung off the street. And into the stable, the sheriff said, "Hello, Jim." Jim Bailey swung off his saddle and came over close to the sheriff. He said, "Nick, I got here as quick as I could. Somebody shot and killed Chiquita Morales last night." The big sheriff stared at Jim Bailey, while Frenchie Arnett said, "Aw, God, they didn't do that, Jim." Bailey nodded grimly. "She must have been in town, Frenchie, in a buggy. They tied the horse about a mile out of town and shot her." Hashknife did not ask any questions as the sheriff said wearily, "We're heading home right now, Jim. Doc Miles left about 3 o'clock with the body of Oren Blakely." "It's sure getting to be an awful tough country," sighed Jim Bailey. "She was settin' there in the buggy." "Shut up," snapped Frenchie sharply. He dropped his reins and walked over to the big sliding doors where he stood, staring out at the street. Jim Bailey shook his head. "Chiquita was Frenchie's sweetheart," whispered the sheriff. "That's what he thought, Meb," said Bailey. Bailey and Frenchie rode ahead, leaving the sheriff to ride with Hashknife and Sleepy. "We heard that the bank went busted in Tomahawk Flats," remarked Hashknife. "Robbed," corrected the sheriff. "Three men. Cleaned it out, eh? Nothing left, and it busted a lot of folks. You see, Thomas Colton owned the bank, the Cattlemen's Independent Bank. Old Ede Weed was the cashier. It was a good bank, too, with plenty cash. Tom Colton is a fine feller, everybody liked him. He played square with everybody, never hounded him on mortgages and all that. Well, a short time ago, three men got into Ede Weed's house, made him give him the combination of the safe, took his keys, tied old Ede up so tight that he ain't rid of the kinks yet, and took their sweet time in bustin' the bank. They emptied the vault. As far as we can find out, there wasn't a thin dime left. It broke a lot of folks, I'll tell ya that. I lost $700 myself." "Where," asked Hashknife, "does this Chiquita Morales figure in the deal, sheriff?" "She don't. Her father, Pete Morales, owns a little rancho. Chiquita is about 18, I reckon, and as pretty as a bug's ear. I'm past 40 and I'm married, but every time she looked at me and grinned, I lost at least 15 years of age. They're poor, the Morales are, poor old Pete, this'll hit him hard." "No idea who busted the bank, eh?" queried Sleepy. The sheriff sat disgustedly. "We've got a prisoner," he said. "Oh, ya caught one of 'em, eh?" remarked Hashknife. "Quinn Sabe? Ya see, it's this-a-way. Andy Davidson, we call him Uncle Andy, and his wife Aunt Judy, the finest folks ya ever knowed, have a son Johnny. Johnny's fine, hell, ya can't have a pa and ma like them and not be fine. Johnny's engaged to marry Nell Frawley on Christmas Eve. Well, Johnny's in jail." "It don't seem to work out," said Hashknife. "That's right, but there he is. Ya see, Johnny wears a ring, that is, he did. Navajo, I reckon. Big ring, silver and with a turquoise cross, anybody'd know that ring. Tom Weed says that one of the men who robbed the bank wore that ring. Johnny didn't have it on his finger when we arrested him, and he can't tell us where it is. He just sits there in his cell, staring at the bars. It's a tough situation, Hartley." "Well, can't he prove where he was that night?" asked Sleepy. "If he can, he won't. Ya can't get a word out of him." "What does his girl think of the deal?" asked Sleepy. "Nell Frawley." "Lord, I dunno what she thinks. Nell is one of the finest ya ever seen, and ya can't beat her folks. They got hit awful hard in that bank bust, but I don't reckon they got hit as hard as Uncle Andy Davidson. He's flat, but he ain't kickin'. If Johnny was out of jail, well, I don't think Uncle Andy is givin' a thought to Lawson the money." "I can imagine," said Hashknife thoughtfully. "A fine Christmas for folks like that. That's right, Hartley, I'd plumb forgot about Christmas. Peace on, Earth, don't fit so good in dancin' Devil Valley this season. After a full minute of silent writing, the sheriff commented, I plumb forgot to ask you fellers how come you're headin' for dancin' Devil Valley? Hashknife studied the bobbing ears of his horse for several moments, his eyes narrowed thoughtfully. Then he looked at the sheriff and said, Sheriff, you know what a wild goose is, don't ya? Of course I do. We're chassin' one, said Hashknife. The sheriff scratched his stubbled chin, looked sideways at Hashknife, but rode on, thinking it over. These two rather puzzled the law officer. They looked like a pair of drifting cowpokes, but why would a drifting cowpoke be looking for wild geese in the dancing devil country, he wondered. Funny thing, too, when that Hartley person looked at you and said something, you believed him. Even such a fantastic thing as chasing a wild goose. It was afternoon when they arrived in Tomahawk Flats, and the sheriff and coroner left immediately to get the body of the murdered Mexican girl. Men had guarded it since the discovery. Hashknife and Sleepy registered at the hotel where folks talked about the crime wave. The murder of Orrin Blakely was secondary in importance. A man might get killed at any time, but for somebody to deliberately murder a girl, that needed attention. I seen Pete Morales and his old woman a while ago, one man said. God, you'd think the roof fell on both of them. It sure did, nodded a grizzled cowman. I lost one once, but she wasn't shot to death. That's worse if it can be. Yeah, I knew. Mrs. Morales just sat there, counting her beads, moving, her lips never looked up at all. She wasn't crying, just counting, I reckon. I kinda figured that her and Frenchie would get hitched, said another of the men. They used to go down into Mexico to dances and all that. Frenchie can talk Mexican pretty good. Hashknife and Sleepy went up to their room to leave their war bags. Sleepy flung his bag into a corner and stood there, his hands on his hips, looking at Hashknife, who sat down to roll a cigarette. Go ahead, partner, say it, he remarked. Yeah, just a couple real estate men on horseback, snorted Sleepy. Bob Marsh didn't know things like this would happen, Sleepy, he's no fortune teller, it just happened, that's all. Yeah, all right, be stubborn. We're here, ain't we? Pitchforked into it by Bob Marsh. He knowed the bank was busted. Meb he knew, Johnny Davidson was in jail. We came straight from his doggone office, real estate, your eye. Hashknife lighted his cigarette and inhaled deeply. It's a terrible thing, murderin' a girl, Sleepy. That's right, terrible, terrible thing to murder a man, too. Even if Bob Marsh knew, lossin' faith in him, eh, that's fine. Now we can start even. And there's a job to be done, Sleepy. After a long pause, we've got a good alibi for Bane down here, real estate men on horseback. They ate supper in a little Mexican restaurant where they found Frenchie. Arnett, more than half drunk, imbibing tequila with his meal. He didn't speak to them, merely looked at them through bloodshot eyes and went on, drinking. Frenchie was gone when they paid for their meal. Frenchie feel pretty bad, I think so, said the Mexican proprietor. Tequila won't help him much, remarked Sleepy. Nothing help him much, amigo, too bad. The murder of Chiquita Morales had sobered Tomahawk Flats. Even in the big Pasatiempo saloon, men talked in subdued tones, placed chips carefully into the jackpots. The roulette layout was not even uncovered. A man said, I'd sure like to pull the rope on that dirty murderer. Another man laughed shortly and said, fine chance, the best our sheriff can do is put Johnny Davidson in jail. Wouldn't have got him if the blamed fool hadn't worn that ring. One cinch, said a gambler, they can't put that onto Johnny, he was locked up tight, but I can't figure out why anybody'd shoot the girl. As far as that goes, why was Orrin Blakely shot? Orrin was a good homber, remarked another. I talked with Sam Hack a while ago, and he said that all he knew was that Orrin left the ranch, headin' for here. Why he went to Northgate, nobody seems to know. Somebody did, said the gambler, and that somebody had a shotgun and a load of buckshot. Well, I dunno, it beats me. Beats the sheriff, too, said another. You watch, he'll never get either of the killers. Hashknife and Sleepy slept late next morning, ate breakfast in the hotel, dining room, and when they came back to the lobby, they saw an elderly couple talking with the hotel keeper. The man was small, thin, bow-legged, smooth-shaved, almost bird-like in his movements. The woman was gray-haired, tall, slender, sad-looking. The hotel keeper saw Hashknife and Sleepy come from the dining room doorway and motioned to the man, who got up very quickly from his chair and came over to Hashknife. Your name is Hartley. He asked quietly. That's right, smiled Hashknife. I'm Andy Davidson, A.D. Spread. Mind talking to me for a few minutes? I'd like to, Mr. Davidson. Everybody calls me Uncle Andy. My friends call me Hashknife Uncle Andy. Yeah, that's the name in the letter I got a few minutes ago. I'll show it to ya. Hashknife read the short letter from Bob Marsh, which said, I am in receipt of your telegram a few minutes ago, and in reply I can Say that two men, Hashknife Hartley and Sleepy Stevens, are either now in your town or soon will be. I have perfect confidence in them and their ability. Please keep this confidential. For that reason, I am writing you rather than to use a telegram. There was a postscript which said, "Give my regards to Sleepy." Hashknife smiled slowly, folded the letter, and gave it back to Uncle Andy, who was looking closely at him. Hashknife motioned to Sleepy, who came over. "Uncle Andy," said Hashknife, "I want you to meet Sleepy Stevens. Sleepy, this is Uncle Andy Davidson. He just got a letter from Bob Marsh." "Bob's quite a hand to write letters," remarked Sleepy. "Did he send me his regards?" "By doggies," exclaimed Uncle Andy. "He did just that. He always does," said Sleepy. "Anyway, I'm glad to meet ya, Uncle Andy." They shook hands, and Uncle Andy introduced them to Aunt Judy Davidson, who also shook hands with them soberly. "We're in a peck of trouble, boys," said Uncle Andy. "We heard about it," said Hashknife quietly. "Trouble seems plentiful around here. You see, we just got off the train at Northgate when Orrin Blakely was shot." "Orrin was a nice boy," offered Aunt Judy. "I'm sorry about him. Isn't it terrible about Chiquita Morales? I liked her." "Is there anybody you dislike?" asked Hashknife, smiling. Aunt Judy thought carefully, finally shaking her head. "I just can't remember any," she said seriously. They sat down and Uncle Andy said, "How much of the story have you heard, Hashknife?" "The sheriff told us most of it written down here." "Nick has been awful nice to us," said Aunt Judy. "It isn't his fault, he had to do his duty." "She excuses everybody," said Uncle Andy. "You too?" queried Sleepy. "Not always, Sleepy. I'm about the only person she ever blames." "Tell me about this ring, the evidence against your son," said Hashknife. "Well," replied Uncle Andy, "Johnny bought it from a feller in Northgate. It's a big, silver contraption, and the satin is a turquoise cut in the shape of a cross. Anybody'd remember it if they seen it once. Awful gaudy, I thought." "Beautiful," added Aunt Judy. "It was a little small for Johnny, and he had to wear it on his little finger. Very heavy." "Edweed recognized it," said Uncle Andy sadly. "He'd seen it lots of times, but Johnny, darn his soul, won't tell what he done with it, just sets there and shakes his head." "Yussie," Uncle Andy cleared his throat. Harshly, "Yussie, Johnny and Nell Frawley was due to get married Christmas Eve. Loveliest girl I ever knew," said Aunt Judy wearily. "I'm wondering if Johnny would talk with me," said Hashknife. Uncle Andy shook his head. "I don't believe he would. Won't talk to anybody, not even a lawyer. Stubborn's a bull calf." "He might," said Aunt Judy hopefully, but added, "He ought to. Nobody can help him if he won't talk." "Let's try it," suggested Hashknife. "He can't no more than refuse." "All right," replied Uncle Andy. "We'll try, but don't say I didn't warn ya, Hashknife." They found Nick McGarvin in the office. He didn't think that Johnny would talk, especially to strangers, but was willing for them to try. Johnny Davidson was a good-looking young cowboy, but he had stubborn eyes and a stubborn chin. Uncle Andy introduced Hashknife and Sleepy to him, but he didn't seem interested. "These here men want to help ya, Johnny," explained Uncle Andy. "But before they can help ya, they've got to hear your story." "I have no story," declared Johnny stonily. "Nothing to tell." Hashknife moved in close to the bars, and Johnny looked at him rather defiantly at first. Their eyes met for several moments, and Johnny turned away, looking at his mother. "Johnny, you ought to talk to him," she said quietly. Johnny looked at Hashknife again, and a weak smile twisted his lips for a moment. Then he said, "All right, what do I talk about?" "That ring, Johnny," replied Hashknife. "We've got to know what you done with it." Johnny shook his head. "It won't do a bit of good," he said. "It can't do any good now, it's too damned late, Hartley." "Why is it too late?" asked Hashknife. "Because Chiquita Morales is dead. Orrin Blakely is dead, too," Uncle Andy said. "What did Chiquita?" "Wait," interrupted Hashknife. "Johnny can tell us in his own way. Go ahead, Johnny." Johnny gnawed at his lower lip for several moments, his eyes bleak. Hashknife noticed that his hands were clenched behind him. Finally, he said, "I traded that ring to Chiquita Morales for a pinto horse. She wanted the ring, I wanted that pintado. I was going to tell Nell about it. I dunno, Meb Nell was a little jealous of Chiquita. She didn't mean anything to me, Chiquita didn't. There wasn't any bill of sale, nothing, to prove I traded. I was going to get the pinto, and that's all there was to it. She wanted the ring to wear to a dance, so I let her have it. I was down at Agua Verde that night, but I left there about 7 o'clock. On the way back at a little rancho, there was a lot of music, so I stopped to see what was going on. It was a dance, a pretty wild dance, too. Chiquita was there with Orrin Blakely. Everybody was drunk except Chiquita, and there had been several fistfights. Orrin was drunk, too. Chiquita wanted to go home to get away from the place. Well, at least, my gentleman, I hope. We got Orrin on a horse, and all three of us came back across the line. Oren wasn't too drunk then, so we put him on the road to the Circle H and I took Chiquita home. And you was afraid that Nell would find it out? Asked Uncle Andy. Yeah, I was, admitted Johnny. Maybe I had no business doing it, talking her home and all that, but I did. Was she wearing the ring at the dance? Asked Hashknife. No, she wasn't, replied Johnny. I asked her where it was and she told me she left it at home because it was too big and she was afraid. She'd lose it. I'll explain it to Nell, offered Aunt Judy. Thanks, Ma, but I'd rather tell her. I didn't take Chiquita to the dance, didn't even know she was there, and when she explained that she was scared to stay there, what could I do? Couldn't anybody at that rancho testify that you were there instead of robbing a bank? Asked Uncle Andy. I doubt it, because I didn't mix in the dance. And anyway, said Johnny, nobody knows what time of night the bank was robbed. Eadweed didn't know. They woke him up, but he never seen a clock. I heard that Chiquita was to marry Frenchie Arnett, said Hashknife. Quinsabe, Johnny smiled sourly. Chiquita liked to have fun. She asked me to not tell Frenchie. I wouldn't anyway, it wasn't my business. Johnny, said Hashknife, do you know of anybody who hated Oren Barkley enough to shoot him? Maybe somebody who knew he took Chiquita to a dance. Johnny shook his head. No, I don't, Hartley. Frenchie was supposed to be keeping steady company with Chiquita. Frenchie was either in Northgate or on his way up there when she was killed. Oren wasn't quarrelsome. In fact, that night was the first time I had ever seen him drunk. Oh, he took a drink now and then, I suppose, but not enough to affect him. Well, much obliged, Johnny, said Hashknife, shaking hands through the bars. You're welcome, Hartley. Glad to have met ya, and you too, Stevens. He kissed his mother between the bars and they went out. Aunt Judy took hold of Hashknife's shoulders and turned him around on the sidewalk, looking straight into his eyes. I just wanted to find out why Johnny talked to you, she said as he smiled slowly at her. Don't be silly, Ma, grinned Uncle Andy. I'm not silly, she said quietly and turned away. Hashknife patted her on the shoulder. I dunno how it was done, but it was, Uncle Andy said. Hashknife, we want you and Sleepy to make the ranch your home. We've got room out there, and we'd sure admire having ya stay there. Later, maybe, said Hashknife. Thank ya both a lot. Make it when ya can, we'll be looking for ya. Nick McGarvin, the sheriff, was a little amazed over the willingness of Johnny Davidson to talk to a stranger. And he was also a bit curious as to just why Andy Davidson had brought these two strangers to the jail for the conference. He asked Johnny, who thought it over for several moments. I don't know, Nick, he said. Mother and Dad brought him in here, and Hartley, the tall one, asked me questions. Which you answered, said the sheriff dryly. That's right, I did, but don't ask me why, Nick. It is kind of funny. Something about him, I dunno what. Pete Morales and his wife came to town, and the sheriff asked Pete if he knew anything about Chiquita trading a pinto horse to Johnny Davidson for a turquoise ring. Pete shook his head sadly. My amigo, he said wearily, I know nothing except Chiquita E's died. I see no riang. Did you know that Chiquita went to the dance in Mexico with Oren Blakely? Again the little Mexican shook his head. No, he said huskily. I tell her, kip to hell from those dance at Miguel's rancho, bad people down there. But I think she go anyway. Nick McGarvin went back to his office. Frenchie hadn't showed up yet. The death of Chiquita Morales was a terrible blow to the little deputy, and he was drinking too much. Sam Hack and his only remaining cowboy, Gus Staley, came over to the sheriff's office. Hack was a tall, gaunt man with deep-set eyes, long arms and huge, bony hands. Hack was really a newcomer to the dancing, Devil Range having bought the NK spread from the bank, which had it on a foreclosure and registered his own brand. Oren Blakely had been one of his two men. Gus Staley was rather a nondescript cowpoke who liked liquor and cards. Hack wanted action. He said, Nick, you've got to do something about the murder of Oren. Ya can't let things like that go. Suggest something, replied the harassed sheriff. It's easy to talk. About Sam, nobody knows why Oren headed for Northgate. Nobody knows who wanted to shoot him. Everyone seemed to like him. If you know anything else, let me know. Well, replied Hack soberly, I wish I could, Nick. Has Johnny Davidson talked yet? Johnny talked this morning, Sam. He wouldn't talk to me, and he wouldn't talk to his ma and pa, but he talked to a stranger. Meanin' what? Asked Hack flatly. The sheriff shook his head. I dunno, Sam, I can't figure it. And then the sheriff told them what Johnny told Hashknife. Sam Hack and Gus Staley listened closely while the sheriff related Johnny's story, and the sheriff finished with, I asked Johnny why he told all this to Hartley when he wouldn't talk with anybody else and he said he didn't know. Kinda funny, remarked Hack. He turned to Staley, Gus, did you know that Oren took Chiquita to that dance? Staley shook his head. Oren didn't talk much, he replied. He was drunk when he got back to the ranch that night, but he didn't say where he'd been. I figured he got drunk here. Gus, said the sheriff, you've been with Orin a long time. If I remember right, you came here with him. Do you know anybody who hated him enough to shoot him? Hell no, snorted Gus Staley. Well, there ya are, said the sheriff, shrugging helplessly. Gus has been bunkin' the man all this time, and even he don't know who'd shoot him. Who is Hartley and Stevens? Asked Hack. The sheriff smiled. I rode all the way down here from Northgate with them too, he said, and all I know is that they've each got two legs and two arms. You might ask Andy Davidson, he seemed to know 'em. Just a couple driftin' cowpokes, eh? You name 'em, replied the sheriff. They came in on the freight train, got off at Northgate just before Orin climbed on and got shot. They had their saddles along with 'em, and I know they bought two horses at the feed corral. Well, yawned Hack, we've got to be driftin', Nick. When is the inquest? Tomorrow morning, Doc Talbert told me. You'll be here? Yeah. After all, Orin was one of my boys. Hashknife and Sleepy sprawled on chairs under the porch of the hotel. Hashknife, as relaxed as a cat, smoked thoughtfully, paying little attention to activity on the street. How much of Johnny Davidson's story do ya reckon a jury would believe? Inquired Sleepy. Very little, Sleepy. Do you believe him? Certainly, I believe him. With all the lies possible, he told a story. That can't possibly help him. The girl is dead, and he didn't have to tell the truth about the ring. The kid's honest. You're like Aunt Judy, everybody is all right. Sam Hack and Gus Staley came past the porch and went on up the street. Both of them looked curiously at Hashknife and Sleepy. Frank Olds, the hotel keeper, standing in the doorway of the hotel, waved a greeting to them, and he said to the two cowboys, that's the feller Orin Blakely worked for, Sam Hack. He's the tall one, the other is Gus Staley. Is Hack an old-timer down here? Asked Hashknife. No, he came here a little over a year ago and bought out the NK. Bought it from the bank, I reckon. They held a big mortgage, and Kinney, the owner, couldn't make the grade. You knew Blakely? Asked Sleepy. Yeah, nice boy, too. I know most everybody. Growed up here. I hear, remarked Hashknife lazily, that the bank bust hurt folks pretty hard around here. Busted some of them. Ya take Andy Davidson and Ede Frawley, they got hit awful hard. Had most all their money in the bank, I've been told. Davidson just sold a trainload of cows, and they tell me he lost every cent in the bank. Frawley got hit about as hard. They ain't. Kickin' cause they ain't that kind. What do ya think of Johnny Davidson's chances? Asked Sleepy. Well, I'll tell ya, with that ring as evidence and with a dancin', devil jury, he's got about as much chance as a celluloid cat has in. Hell, the jury will believe Ede Weed. I hate to see it happen to the Davidson family, but Johnny is stuck. What happened to the banker? Asked Sleepy. Oh, he's still livin' here. Tom Colton's his name, got sort of a no-good son named Harry. He tried to make a banker out of him, but it didn't work. Make a better banker for a faro game, I reckon. Drinks like a fish, Harry does. After all this information, Frank Olds went back to his hotel work, and Hashknife and Sleepy walked over to the livery stable. The stableman was also a loquacious soul. He was standing in the rear doorway of the stable, staring out at a rather dilapidated top buggy. He said, complainingly, I wish they'd take that damn thing away from here. Why? Asked Sleepy. That's the buggy Chiquita Morales was killed in. They brung it here, said that it was meb evidence. Huh, blood all over it too, I sleep in, the tack room, and I dream about that blasted old buggy. Chiquita was awful pretty. I dunno, I reckon it'll stay there until the sheriff takes it away. Hashknife walked out and looked it over. Not much of a buggy, the worn, cushion spattered with gore, dried black now, a broken buggy whip in the old socket, ready to fall off the dash. Sleepy and the stableman had turned to talk with someone when Hashknife pulled the seat cushion loose from the back. Something rattled loosely, and Hashknife readied in and picked it up. One swift glance and he put the object in his pocket, shoved the cushion into place, and walked back to the doorway. A young man was talking with the stableman, paying him some money. He was wearing store clothes, except for his high-heel boots, and seemed just a trifle inebriated. A good-looking young man, too, except for the deep lines of dissipation in his face. After he went out, the stableman said, that's Harry Colton, the busted banker's son. He keeps his horse here, in the stable, and pays his bills regular. I hate to see a young man drinking that away. His old man tried to keep him straight, but I don't reckon it was any use. Too much money and nothing else to do. Meb, suggested Sleepy. He won't have too much money now. Did ya hear what he said? Asked the stableman. Sleepy shook his head. He said he'd probably have to sell his horse. Can't afford to pay feed bills much longer. He might cut down on his whiskey bills, suggested Hashknife. You don't know Harry, grinned the stableman. They walked back to the hotel and went up to their room, where Hashknife took the object from his pocket and placed it on the table. It was a huge Mexican silver ring with a turquoise cross. Sleepy stared at it, picked it up gingerly, and examined it. He put it back on the table and sat down by the window. It was under that seat cushion, said Hashknife. Maybe, suggested Sleepy. Chiquita thought she was Bane held up and hid it under the cushion. It kinda figures out like this, said Hashknife. Chiquita made the trade with Johnny. She wasn't in love with Johnny, but it kinda seems that she wasn't a one-man woman. Before the robbery, she let somebody have that ring. Maybe she got it back. Maybe she was scared to keep it. Maybe she hid it under the cushion. Maybe, after all that, interrupted Sleepy, what do you think actually happened? I don't know, grinned Hashknife and pocketed the ring. This can't help Johnny none, said Sleepy. I don't reckon it can help anybody, smiled Hashknife, but it's a mighty pretty ring. They went back to the hotel lobby where they were accosted by an elderly, well-dressed man. He said, you are Mr. Hartley. That's my name, nodded Hashknife. I am Thomas Colton, Mr. Hartley. Shall we sit down? Sleepy sprawled on a chair near a window, while Hashknife and Thomas, Colton, former banker, sat down together. The banker said, I have a confidential letter from a land syndicate in Phoenix, saying that they are interested in buying cattle ranches in the Dancing Devil Range as an investment and asking about prices. Today I received this telegram, which I will show you. The telegram was sent to the banker and signed James Morrison. It read, advise you that a Mr. Hartley is authorized to contact ranch owners and consult them on prices. Hashknife read the telegram and handed it back to Colton, who said, quietly, the bank holds paper against nearly every ranch down. Here, rather big paper, I might say, and I understand that, interrupted Hashknife, but mortgages have nothing to do with my job, I merely ask prices. And I might say, continued the banker, that few, if any, can meet their mortgages. Confidentially, Mr. Hartley, the ranches of this valley are in bad shape. I mean, financially, of course. Nothing wrong with the ranches? Queried Hashknife. This looks like a good range. Oh, it is, indeed. That is one reason that the bank was generous. Have you made any inquiries, Mr. Hartley? I didn't want to rush 'em, said Hashknife. Why? Well, I no reason at all, except that I might be able to get a better price than you could knowing conditions. Hashknife smiled as he looked at Colton. Maybe you don't think I'm the right man to buy cattle ranches, he suggested. No, no, I didn't mean that. After all, the Cattlemen's Association wouldn't recommend a man who wasn't capable. Thank ya, said Hashknife dryly. You go ahead, Mr. Colton. Maybe you can do better than I could. Anyway, it's worth trying. Well, thank you, Mr. Hartley. I'll see what I can do and then we can compare notes. I'll see you again and thank you. It might be well to not mention our little talk to anyone. I'll keep still, agreed Hashknife. Sleepy was curious and came over as soon as Colton left. Hashknife told him the conversation and Sleepy said, what's he trying to do, beat us out of our jobs? Even a banker can make a mistake, partner, smiled Hashknife. He's sure mistaken if he thinks he can take our jobs over, declared Sleepy. I like to draw money for loafing. A double inquest was held next forenoon in Tomahawk Flats, and it seemed as though everybody in Dancing Devil Valley came to listen, because they had been present at the shooting of Orrin Blakely. Both Hashknife and Sleepy were called to the stand to testify. Both Aunt Judy and Uncle Andy were there, and with them sat Ede Frawley and his daughter Nell. Huddled together were Pete Morales and his wife, listening closely but not understanding much of what was said. Frenchie Arnett was there still, half drunk. Sam Hack and his one man, Gus Staley, were there, and Uncle Andy introduced Hashknife and Sleepy to Buck Nolan, who owned the bar, and there was no one to testify in the murder of Chiquita Morales. They put Pete Morales on the stand, but Pete either didn't understand or had nothing to tell them. The jury in both cases brought in the only possible verdict, killed by a party or parties unknown. Hashknife and Sleepy met the Davidsons on the street after the inquest and were introduced to Nell Frawley and her father. Nell was a pretty brunette, tall and willowy, but very sad over the plight of Johnny Davidson. Aunt Judy said, Ede, you and Nell are coming out to have supper with us, and I'm asking Hashknife and Sleepy to come out with us. What are we waiting for? Asked Sleepy quickly. But Aunt Judy, we didn't intend, began Ede Frawley. Don't lie to me, Ede Frawley, she said. I saw that hunger for sour milk biscuits in your eye when I mentioned supper. Well, I sure, agreed Frawley, while Sleepy remarked, speaking about love, I ain't had a sour milk biscuit since all settin'. Bull got up and leaned against a tree. As Sleepy said, remarked Uncle Andy, what are we waiting for, folks? It isn't noon yet, said Ede Frawley. Don't you folks eat at noon? Asked Sleepy soberly. Let's go out to the ranch, said Aunt Judy. I've got to fill him up before he starves on our hands. The ranch house and buildings at the AD were well kept, the grounds clean. Uncle Andy admitted to Hashknife that Aunt Judy was responsible for the appearance of the place. they met Ted Evans and Eddie Connors, the two cowpokes. "I've a luz wanted to see what you looked like, Hartley," remarked Connors. "Wanted to see what I looked like," queried Hashknife. "Yeah, that's right. I heard about you up on the Wind River, and then I heard more about ya in Colorado, and the last feller to speak about ya was from the Thunder River country. I didn't know I was worth talking about," said Hashknife. "Well, I'm telling ya," grinned Connors. "If you're half as good as the lies I've heard, you're a ring-tailed wonder." "I'm not, Connors," assured Hashknife. "Men will lie, you know. Then I sure ran into several, Hartley, and they all lied about the same things." "What's this all about?" demanded Aunt Judy. "Somebody trying to ruin my reputation, Aunt Judy." "Ruin it," exclaimed Connors. "Let me tell ya what." "Don't repeat it, there's ladies present," interrupted Hashknife, and went into the house with the others. Nell volunteered to help Aunt Judy in the kitchen, and two ranch owners sat down with Hashknife and Sleepy in the main room. There was plenty of food for conversation, but no one seemed inclined to start it until Ede, Frawley, his pipe drawing well, said, "Andy, have you talked with Tom Colton?" "Not for a couple of days, Ede. I talked with him this morning. It seems that he's representing a land-buying syndicate and they'd like to buy the Rafter F if they can get it cheap enough." "Yeah, the buzzards are already winging in, eh?" "That's what I told him." "I can see his angle," said Uncle Andy. "We owe money to the bank, which don't exist now. Him Bain, the owner of the bank, wants his money out of the deal." "And we can't pay him," said Frawley flatly. "If we get any kind of a decent offer, we'll have to sell." Uncle Andy turned to Hashknife. "Sorry to talk about something you don't know about," he said. "I'll tell ya how I'm fixed. I owe the bank $12,000. Not long ago, I sold a lot of beef and I put $28,000 on deposit. I wanted to pay off that mortgage right now, but Colton said, oh, I don't understand banking, Hashknife. Something about having to pay a lot of interest and a bonus. If I took it up now, so I let it lay. Well, the $28,000 is gone and I can't pay the mortgage." "I'm in the same boat," said Frawley. "My mortgage was due 2 days after the robbery. I owed Colton $10,000 and I had enough in there to pay it off and not mind." "Tough deal," murmured Hashknife. "Just how was this robbery pulled off?" "I can tell ya what Weed said," replied Uncle Andy. "Weed is a bachelor living alone, been here years. He said he went to bed, but he don't know what time, maybe 9 o'clock, and went to sleep. He don't know what time he woke up, but the lamp was lighted and three masked men was around him. They told him they wanted the key to the bank and the combination of the vault. One of them told him that he'd either do what they want or they'd kill him, take the keys to the bank and bust it with dynamite. They got the keys and the combination, tied Weed up tight and pulled out. They had all night to do the job and they sure done a complete job. And he saw that turquoise ring, eh?" said Hashknife, and Davidson nodded slowly. "He says he saw it plain. Weed is honest, eh?" "Honest as a dollar," sighed Uncle Andy. "I've talked with him several times and he's just about sick. Weed is pretty old and he ain't got any job. Everything he owned was in the bank too." "I told him," said Frawley quietly, "that if things got too tough, he could come out and live with us." "I told him the same thing," said Uncle Andy, "and so did Buck Nolan. Buck didn't owe the bank anything, but he lost every dollar he had in there." "Seems like we're asking Weed to join us in the poorhouse," said Frawley dryly. "I know I can't keep going. I've got a couple good cowpokes out at my place, but I can't afford to keep them more than a couple weeks longer." "This looks like a mighty good range," remarked Sleepy. "There ain't any better," declared Uncle Andy warmly. "Maybe they'll offer ya a good price." "Why should they?" asked Frawley. "Colton didn't suggest any price. He said they'd naturally buy as cheap as possible, and he said for me to figure out my lowest price. He'll probably make you the same proposition, Andy." Uncle Andy stared thoughtfully at the carpet for several moments before he said quietly, "We've been here a long time, Ede. It ain't just like selling a piece of property, it's home. Ya can't tear up roots that have gone as deep as where's my friend. We ain't young men, me and you. Ede, I just can't sell the AD." "I feel the same, Andy," replied Frawley. "Will Nolan have to sell too?" asked Hashknife. "I dunno, Hashknife," replied Uncle Andy. "It hit him hard, but he don't owe the bank anything. What about Sam Hack?" "I don't believe he had much in the bank. You see, he's only had the Circle H a little over a year. He bought out the NK from a feller named Kinney. The bank had to foreclose a mortgage on the NK, and I reckon Hack made a good deal for the spread. He's building it up." "How long," asked Hashknife, "has Colton owned the bank?" "A little over 2 years," replied Frawley. "Weed worked for the bank. For at least 20 years, Harry Colton was in college when his father bought the bank and has only been here about a year. He's no good, drinks like a fish, and gambles like a fool. He had the gall to want Nell to marry him." "That," declared Sleepy soberly, don't take much gall. You know what I mean, Stevens, laughed Frawley. Hashknife walked out into the kitchen. Aunt Judy was working at the stove, while Nell was on the back porch talking with Eddie Connors, who went down the steps and headed for the bunkhouse. Hashknife went out on the shaded porch. Nell said, "Your ears must have burned, Mr. Hartley." Hashknife smiled and shook his head. "I haven't felt them. We were talking about you." "That's a pretty dry topic for conversation," he said soberly. Eddie didn't think so. "Oh, I didn't want to be curious, but Uncle Andy talked about you and Eddie," she hesitated. "That's the trouble," he said quietly. "Something ordinary happens and somebody with a big imagination spins a windy about it. The next feller enlarges it. Well, after it's been told several times, you've either got wings and one of them halos or a forked tail and a pair of horns. But even with all the lies, the poor devil remains a tired all cowpoke. Just get along in his own dumb way, ma'am." "You're not so old," said Nell. "I'm old enough to know better, ma'am. I don't like to be called ma'am. My name is Nell." Hashknife smiled slowly. "I like that name. I'm Hashknife. Just a poor, old, tired cowpoke," she said slowly. "Johnny said you just looked at him and he decided to tell the truth, but he wouldn't talk to anybody before that. How did you do it, Hashknife?" Hashknife looked at her thoughtfully. "I just asked him, Nell. Do people always do what you ask?" "Well," Hashknife grinned widely, "I don't ask much. Did you know Chiquita Morales very well?" "Are you practicing on me?" asked Nell quickly. "No, I just wondered if you knew her pretty well." "Not too well," replied Nell. "Chiquita was pretty, tiny, full of life. She liked to have a good time, wear pretty clothes. But the Morales are poor people. I don't believe they had much control over her. I liked her. She was very generous, sympathetic, but very emotional." "Do you think she would have married Frenchie Arnett, Nell?" "No, I don't, Hashknife. Frenchie was too slow for her. She went to that Mexican dance with Oren Blakely and Frenchie didn't know it. If Chiquita wanted to go someplace, she'd ask most any man to take her. She didn't have any favorites, it seemed." "The Morales are pretty poor, eh?" remarked Hashknife. "Yes, they are. I never could understand where Chiquita got money to buy fancy clothes, but she wore plenty." "Maybe some cowpoke bottom," suggested Hashknife, "at $40 a month. "No, that don't go far," admitted Hashknife. "Did you ever know her to go to dances with Harry Colton? With the banker's son, you amaze me, Hashknife." Hashknife smiled slowly. "I even amaze myself at times, Nell." "No, I never have seen them together," she said. "No reason why not. After all, Harry Colton isn't too good in spite of his money. Now that his father is broke, I don't know what he will do." Aunt Judy came out on the porch to cool off. "Who are you folks plotting against?" she asked. "The forces of evil, Aunt Judy," replied Nell. "Well, it must have been pleasant plotting, the way you've been smiling. Isn't she a sweet girl, Hashknife?" "Aunt Judy," protested Nell. "I've been thinking that all along," grinned Hashknife. "How come you never got married?" asked Aunt Judy. "Well," replied Hashknife thoughtfully, "I don't reckon I've ever had time. My old dad was a range-ridden sky pilot up on the Milk River in Montana. He had a house full of kids and mighty little money to take care of them. When I was still a sprout, I got a horse and a riding rig. I had itchin' feet. Dad said, 'Son, I've been watching you a long time looking at them hills. You want to see what's on the other side? When you was born, the good Lord put a wandering brand on ya. I've seen that brand growing. You'll never call any place home, never be held by any ties. I've tried to teach you to shoot square. It's the best I can do.'" "You started wandering," said Aunt Judy. "All my life, Aunt Judy, Dad's prophecy was right. Sleepy is of the same breed. We can't stay put." "Helping people," said Nell quietly. "Who told you that?" he asked. "Eddie Connors. I think it is wonderful. We need help, Hashknife." Hashknife squinted thoughtfully across the hills. After a long pause, he said, "Yeah, I reckon you do, Nell. Johnny and me were going to get married Christmas Eve. That ain't far away, Nell, and there ain't much to work on, but we'll hope that it's all written our way in the big book." "Big book?" queried Aunt Judy quickly. "There is a big book, you know, Aunt Judy," said Hashknife. "I've never heard of it before." "I've never seen it," smiled Hashknife. "No mortal's eyes have ever seen it, but the finger of fate writes in that book. It shows what we do, how we live, how we die, and when." "That's fatalism," exclaimed Aunt Judy. "You don't believe in that, do you, Hashknife?" "I believe," replied Hashknife, "that you'll never die until your number is up on the board, Aunt Judy. Bein' careful is a human trait, but it won't save ya. Men have gone through hell and high water all their lives only to trip over a chair in the dark and break their neck. What's your argument against it, Aunt Judy?" "Well, when you started, I had several, but I guess I've forgotten what they were." "School is dismissed," grinned Hashknife. "It was a wonderful supper." Aunt Judy was a fine cook and Sleepy almost ate himself under the table. They got back to Tomahawk Flats about 9 o'clock and were standing in front of the Pasatempo Saloon when a horse and buggy drove up. A man had just come out of the saloon and the driver called to him, asking directions for finding Thomas Colton. Home. Then the buggy turned and went back up the street. The man had leaned out of the buggy, his face full in the lights of the saloon. Hashknife said quietly, "Did you see that feller, Sleepy?" "No, I didn't pay any attention. Sort of a fat man, wasn't he?" "Sort of, yeah. I've seen that face before, but I can't quite place him. Come on. Are ya going to try and run him down?" asked Sleepy. "I hadn't thought of that, but I'm curious." Thomas Colton's home was only 2 blocks off the main street, but there were no lights on the street, and the night was dark. They found the horse and buggy at Colton's front gate. There were lights in the house, but the windows were shaded. Sleepy wanted to know why they ever came down there in the first place. Didn't Mr. Colton have any right to have a visitor? Hashknife laughed. "That visitor," he said, "is a man we both knew in Wyoming, Sleepy. His name was Slim Regan. What it is now, who knows?" "Slim Regan?" queried Sleepy. "I remember him. He was a gambler and a promoter, wasn't he?" "That's the person, I'm dead sure. Maybe he didn't recognize me, my back. Bane to the light, and we ain't seen him for at least 5 years. Maybe he's living straight now, who knows?" They started back when they heard footsteps on the wooden sidewalk, coming from the opposite direction. The walker was wearing spurs. It was too dark for them to see him, but he turned in at Colton's gate and went to the house. There were no lights when the door was opened, but they heard it close behind him. "Maybe the Coltons are having a party," suggested Sleepy. Hashknife didn't offer any suggestions, but started down the road, heading in the direction from which the spur-wearing person came. After a short distance, they cut over to the sidewalk and went on until they found the horse tied to a tree almost at the outskirts of town. It was a tall roan animal, and with the aid of a match, they were able to decipher the bar and brand on the animal. Sleepy said, "That's Buck, Nolan's mark, Hashknife." They sat down in the darkness and waited possibly 15 minutes, but no one came along. "Even if he did come for the horse, it's too dark to recognize him. Anyway, there ain't no law," said Sleepy. "I reckon you're right," agreed Hashknife. "No use settin' here." They were almost back at Colton's house when they heard the rasp of buggy wheels as the vehicle was turned around. A few moments later, the horse and buggy came past them, traveling fast, heading back toward where the horse was tied. The Colton house was dark. "Well," remarked Sleepy, "what's funny about that?" "I didn't say it was funny," replied Hashknife. They went up to their room at the hotel and went to bed. Sleepy said, "Ain't we even going to try and get prices on ranches? We'll let Colton see what he can do first. After all, he knows values better than we do." They met Thomas Colton next morning, and he asked them if they had discussed prices with any of the ranchers. "We're leaving that to you, Mr. Colton," said Hashknife. "Well, that is right, Mr. Hartley. No use of both of us working on the same idea. Are you leaving here soon?" "I'll tell ya," replied Hashknife soberly. "If we can buy at a good price, we might take over a spread ourselves." This seemed to confuse Colton. He said, "Well, I yes, of course, I had no idea you well, why not?" "If we got it cheap enough," said Hashknife. "We like this range. After all, a feller ought to settle down." "Yes, I believe we will talk about it again, Mr. Hartley." "Mr. Colton," went on. Sleepy, braced against a porch post, looked inquiringly at Hashknife. "Settlin' down, eh?" he remarked. "That's wonderful. Going to buy a ranch, total assets about $25. If we could get it cheap enough," said Hashknife. "Aunt Judy and Uncle Andy came to town before noon and were talking with Hashknife and Sleepy in front of the sheriff's office when Buck Nolan came riding up to the office. He nodded to them, started for the office doorway when the sheriff came out. Nick, there's a buggy wrecked in Horseshoe Canyon," said Nolan. "I saw where it went over the riprap, and it's down there about 100 feet below the grade. I was coming down from Northgate and—" "You mean a buggy and team went off the grade, Buck?" "It sure looks like it, Nick. You can see some of the buggy all smashed up on the rocks down there. I'll get Frenchie. You take us back there, Buck. Maybe Hartley and Stevens will go with us. We'll need plenty help. I wonder who went off the grade." Hashknife looked curiously at Buck Nolan, big, raw-boned, just a bit gray. Buck was riding a sorrel bearing his own brand. Then Hashknife and Sleepy hurried to the stable to get their horses. Sleepy said, "I'm wondering a little too, Gardner." "We don't know the man, if it's Regan," said Hashknife. "I know what you mean," said Sleepy. "It was several miles out to Horseshoe Canyon." Frenchie went along but showed little interest. He was sober, but his brown eyes were bloodshot from too much whiskey. The coroner went in a spring wagon, taking plenty ropes along. The wheel marks on the edge of the grade were very plain, and they could see part of the smashed buggy. There was a trail into the canyon just above the wreck, and they went down on foot. Slim Regan had been thrown clear of the buggy, but straight into a jumble of jagged rocks. The scent of whiskey still lingered on the dead, man's clothes, and there was a smashed bottle in the bottom of the buggy. They took the body to open ground, where the coroner examined the pockets of his clothes, but all they found was a pocket knife and a few dollars in silver coin. There was not a scrap of paper to identify him. It was quite a task, getting the body back to the grade. The coroner said that there was no question of its being an accident. Hash knife made, no comments. The coroner could be right, except that the wheel marks on the edge of the grade showed the buggy traveling south instead of north. Sleepy had noticed that detail, too, as they rode together off the grade, the latter said. If Slim Regan wanted to pile his carcass into the canyon, why did he turn the buggy around and make the dive? It's just as fatal going north as it is south. Hashknife nodded grimly. He said, keep your eyes open, partner theirs. Brains working down here. They didn't want anybody to know that Regan was in Tomahawk Flats last night. Regan rode up in front of the Passatempo Saloon and asked a man where Tom Colton lived. Who was the man, he asked, Sleepy? Sleepy scowled thoughtfully and finally said, Hashknife, I ain't exactly sure. You see, I wasn't paying much attention, but I kinda seemed to remember that it was Gus Staley. I can't be sure, but I think it was, he works for that feller Hack. Yeah, that's right. Regan went to see Tom Colton, stayed there maybe half an hour, and then pulled out. Regan is a gambler. Was, corrected Sleepy, until he hit bedrock. What do you make out of it? Hashknife didn't say. He thought it over and finally remarked, Sleepy, I wish we knew who the man was who walked in the dark and wore spurs. And rode a bar in Roan, added Sleepy. But what does it add up to? I dunno. Doc Talbert said he'd make a complete examination of the body. That might help our case. But Dr. Talbert's examination didn't help them any. Any evidence of foul play, except by gunshot, would have been wiped out by the man, fall onto the rocks. Nick McGarvin asked that everybody take a look at the body, hoping that someone would identify him, but to no avail. The keeper of the livery stable at Northgate had rented him the horse and buggy, but had no idea where the man was going. He gave the name of Jim Hendricks, paid in advance for the rig, and said he would be gone overnight. Asked about Hendricks having any baggage, the stableman said he wasn't sure, but believed the man had a small valise. Hashknife met Sam Hack and Gus Staley on the street and stopped to talk with them. Did you look at the dead man, Staley? He asked. Yeah, sure, I seen him. Hartley, I don't think back, said Hashknife. Wasn't he the same man who drove up in front of the Passatempo that night and asked you how to find Thomas, Colton's house? Gus Staley looked blankly at Hashknife. I dunno what you mean, he replied. I never seen the man before. You must mean somebody else. I never seen him in a buggy in my life. I see, murmured Hashknife. Well, it don't matter. Didn't the man run off the grade? Common here? Asked Hack. Yeah, it looks that away, replied Hashknife. A couple hundred yards further along the grade is a place where he could turn his outfit around. Maybe he was common back, I dunno. You ain't sure he ever was down here, are ya? Asked Hack, him or his ghost. Ghost, Staley spat viciously into the dusty street. You don't believe in ghosts, do ya, Hartley? I know what I have seen, replied Hashknife seriously, but I never try to impose my ideas on other people. That's all damn foolishment, snorted Staley. When you're dead, you're dead, and that's all there is to it. That's the best way to look at it, remarked Hashknife. Hashknife and Sleepy did not go to the funeral of Chiquita Morales, but they heard that Frenchie Arnett paid most of the expenses. Thomas Colton had approached Uncle Andy regarding selling the AD, but Uncle Andy avoided making any definite price. He knew he would have to sell, eventually, but held off. Hashknife talked with Johnny at the jail, but Johnny was little help. He stuck to his story that he'd traded the ring to Chiquita for a pinto horse and that she didn't wear the ring to that dance in Mexico. Hashknife didn't tell Johnny that he'd found the ring in the Morales buggy. Johnny said, I'm stuck, Hashknife. If Chiquita had lived, she could have testified that I didn't own the ring. That, said Hashknife, is why she died. Johnny, do ya know of any man around here she liked well enough to give that ring? Johnny shook his head. Chiquita, I believe, was a good girl. She liked a good time and she didn't have to want for men to take her places. She wanted money, fine clothes, and all that. You see, a cowpoke's wages don't cover that, Hashknife. Where did she get her finery, Johnny? Pete Morales couldn't afford to buy things for her. Yeah, that's right, I never thought of that. Well, she never tried to get money from anybody, as far as I know. Johnny, did Harry Colton ever go out with her? Johnny leaned against the bars of his cell and thought it over. Finally, he said quietly, I'm just wondering. Johnny might have said more, but Frenchie Arnett came in. He was sober, but grim-faced. Hashknife said, Frenchie, wouldn't you like to know who shot Chiquita? Frenchie shut his eyes tightly for a moment and his jaw tightened. Sure, would, he said quietly, but firmly. I know she went to a dance with Oren Blakely. That was right, Oren didn't do it. Damn right I'd like to know Hartley. Maybe you can help us find him, Frenchie. Did you ever give her money to buy clothes? Give Chiquita money? No, why do you ask that? They say she wore nice clothes. Chiquita always looks nice, silk skirt, pretty shoes. Pete Morales didn't have money to buy them with Frenchie. Frenchie thought it over. Suddenly he faced Hashknife, his eyes hot. You mean to say somebody gave her money, Chiquita? Keep cool, advised Johnny. Hashknife wants to help. She was my girl, said Frenchie huskily. If she wanted money, I'd give it to her. Who gave her money? Oren Blakely didn't have money to give to women who gave her money. You knew about Johnny trading her that ring for a pinto. Sure, I heard that. That is all right, the pinto belonged to her. Frenchie, Chiquita loaned or sold that ring to the man who killed her. Johnny is in jail for a robbery, and the evidence is that ring he traded, Chiquita. She could have told who had that ring. She didn't tell. Because she didn't want that man in jail, but he didn't take a chance. Frenchie shrugged his shoulders. Chiquita go out with other men. Sometimes I warn not here. Sometimes I have no money to spend. I am not her husband. I can't say no. Maybe she don't tell me. That is her business. Frenchie, did she ever go out with Harry Colton? Asked Hashknife. Frenchie's lips shut to a thin line and he walked over to a barred window but came back. I think she did, he said quietly. I accuse her of it, but she just laughed at me. How did you know this, Hartley? I didn't. I just wanted to find out what men she went out with. Chiquita is gone now, Frenchie. Nothing can change that. Our job is to find the man who did it. Sure, she's gone now, breathed Frenchie and walked away, his eyes filled with tears. Hashknife looked at Johnny and shook his head. I'll see ya later, he told Johnny. Hashknife met the sheriff and Sleepy in the office. Hashknife said, Nick, I've had a talk with Johnny and Frenchie. Yeah, did ya find out anything ya already didn't know? If anybody asks ya, Nick, replied Hashknife soberly, you can tell M that Dancin' Devil is in for some surprisin things very soon. In fact, before Christmas. Nick McGarvin's jaw sagged a trifle. Ya mean ya know something, Hashknife? You'd be surprised, Nick. Leaving the sheriff to think this over, Hashknife and Sleepy walked back toward the hotel. He'd be surprised, eh? Remarked Sleepy. That's what I told him, Sleepy. What'd he be surprised about? The few things I know, partner. Listen, will ya? Our only chance to find out something is to scare the guilty into doing something. It works when brains fail, and I don't mind admitting that mine have failed. I know what you mean, said Sleepy quietly. We paint black circles around our heads with a bullseye in the middle. That's right, Nick's human. He'll pass the word. Well, all I can say is that we better find a quiet, remote spot where we can practice dodging bullets, said Sleepy. You know, I think I like it better than setting around, partner. This ain't our idea of a good time anyway. But just remember, Sleepy, we ain't dealing with dumb rustlers in this game, but I figure that even the smartest men will get scared and make a break when they're scared enough. Tomorrow night would be Christmas Eve. They brought him a big fir tree for the little church, but it seemed that the Christmas spirit was lacking. Someone told Hashknife that Thomas Colton was going to be the Santa Claus for the church celebration. The Davidsons and the Frawleys were in town, and Uncle Andy told Hashknife that Colton had asked him to make a price on the AD. He wanted it in a hurry, too, declared Uncle Andy. I told him it wasn't anything I could hurry with. Did he suggest any price? Asked Hashknife. Well, replied Uncle Andy grimly, he said I'd be lucky to get much, more than the cost of the mortgage. About Frawley, he's going to talk to Colton this afternoon, he said. Tell him to hold off Mackin any deal, Uncle Andy. The little cowman looked quizzically at the tall cowboy. What's time got to do with it, Hashknife? He asked. Well, maybe a better price. Anyway, you've got plenty time after the notice of foreclosure to redeem the property. Not with the mortgages from Colton. It specifies that when the bank shuts down on the mortgage, you're through. I see. Mortgage expires, ranch gone, eh? That's the only way he'll loan money, Hashknife. A few minutes later, he met Ede Frawley, who drew him aside. What's going on? Asked Frawley quietly. A man over in the Pasatimpo told me that, well, he said something was going to happen before Christmas, something you said, at least that's the rumor. I hope it's right, Frawley. Funny how things like that get in the wind. You mean there's ain't anything to it, Hashknife? Quinsabe, replied Hashknife soberly. A lot can be done in an hour and Christmas ain't until day after tomorrow. He found Sleepy in front of the hotel and told him, I reckon Nick McGarvin spread the word. I heard it, nodded Sleepy. Frenchie Arnett cornered me and wanted to know, he said, if ya know who shot Chiquita, don't arrest him, just let me know who he is. I said we would. Aw, I didn't mean it, but what else could I tell him? He ain't no deputy sheriff now, he's a wolf with the rabies, partner. The Davidsons and Frawleys stayed in town for supper. Hashknife and Sleepy stayed together, ate supper in a little Mexican restaurant where could sit against the wall. The Mexican who operated the restaurant, usually very voluble, was quiet, serving the enchiladas and frijoles hurriedly, one eye on the door. "I wonder what he's thinking," remarked Sleepy. "I wonder what he knows," said Hashknife. "They tell me he was Chiquita's uncle. Maybe he don't want his place messed up with us." It was dark outside as they paid their bill. With a hand on the knob, Hashknife drew back, turned, and came back to the little counter where the Mexican was at his cash box. "Amigo, is there a back door to this place?" he asked. "Sure," nodded the Mexican. "Go T-Rough the kitchen." They went swiftly through the kitchen, redolent with spices and other odors, out through an old door and into the alley. There was a short, narrow alley leading to the main street, and they could see the silhouette of a man leaning against the right-hand wall, evidently watching for somebody. Hashknife kicked a wooden box aside, making a clatter, and the man moved quickly, stepping up on the wooden sidewalk. Hashknife didn't hesitate but led the way up the alley. The man had passed the little restaurant and was standing at the edge of the sidewalk just beyond. It was too dark for them to see what he looked like, except that he was tall. Finally, he went on up the street toward the hotel. "Do you think he was trying to dry gulch us?" asked Sleepy. "Who knows? He was waiting for somebody, but we scared him away from the alley. He could look through the window and see that we're gone." They went slowly up the sidewalk, watching closely until they were at the front of the hotel. Hashknife peered through the window as he heard Frank Olds, the hotel man, speak sharply to someone. Olds was over near the foot of the stairs, looking up toward the hallway, when he suddenly lifted his arms, shaking his head and protesting, but began walking up the stairs, both hands up. Hashknife jerked away from the window, whispered sharply, "Stay here, trouble in there," and ran down the alley toward the rear stairs of the hotel. Sleepy moved over to the open doorway of the hotel. The sheriff was crossing the street, and Sleepy said as he came up, "Hold it, Nick, until we hear from Hashknife." "What's wrong?" asked the big sheriff. "I don't know, Nick." Hashknife saw something through the window, and he ran around to the back stairs. "He told me to—" Sleepy stopped when two closely spaced shots rattled the windows beside them. Both men sprang through the doorway into the hotel as a figure staggered into view, sagged at the top of the steps, and came pinwheeling down into the lobby. Hashknife ran to the top of the stairs, gun in hand, stopped for a moment, but came on down. Behind him came the disheveled, excited hotel man, waving his arms. The stranger was sprawled at the foot of the stairs, tall, gaunt, unkempt. Hashknife was looking down at him as Sleepy and the sheriff came over. The excited hotel man was jabbering, "He stuck me up, I tell ya, made me come up there or he'd kill me. Hartley, how on earth did you ever beat him? He heard you coming up the stairs. How did you beat him?" "I didn't beat him, he missed me," said Hashknife coldly. "That's Cass Trent," exclaimed the sheriff. "Why, he's Hartley theirs. A half dozen rewards for this hombre. He's living across the border for over a year. He's a killer." "Was," corrected Sleepy, and looked around at the crowd swiftly gathering. The sheriff said, "What was Cass Trent doing here, sticking up a hotel?" "He wasn't sticking me up," denied the hotel keeper. "He was going to bush somebody in that hallway. I came and peeked down the stairs and I seen him. I told him to get out of here and I was going up and run him out, but I didn't." "Man, the boar in his gun looked like a tunnel in a hill." "Going to bush somebody?" queried the sheriff. "Who?" No one seemed to know. Nick McGarvin looked at Hashknife and found the tall, lean cowboy smiling a little. The sheriff said, "Oh," and waited for Dr. Talbert to arrive. A search of Trent's pockets revealed $500 in currency, all in a packet, and the usual impediments carried by cowboys. They took the body to the doctor's place. Nick McGarvin said, "He got what was common to him. Hashknife, you're cleared, and congratulations. They say Cass Trent never missed." "They all miss sometimes, Nick," said Hashknife soberly. "But why would he try to bush you?" asked the sheriff. "You didn't even know him." Hashknife shook his head. "No, I didn't, and I never heard of him until now. He was hired to kill me, Nick." "Hired? Good gosh, who hired him, Hashknife? I can't tell ya, cause I'm not sure." The excitement was mostly over as soon as the body was removed, but there was still a lot of discussion going on. Trent's name was well known down there. Hashknife and Sleepy went over to the Pasatiempo saloon, listening to the gossip. Harry Colton was at the bar, already more than half drunk. Hashknife shoved in beside him, and Colton resented it. However, he looked at Hashknife and decided to give him room. Hashknife was only at the bar a few moments when the sheriff came in. Men were asking him questions about the affair at the hotel when Hashknife drew him aside, whispered a few words. The sheriff looked at him in amazement, but finally nodded. About a minute later, the sheriff arrested Harry Colton, who tried to shove the law officer away, swearing indignantly. The incident brought a lot of attention, but the sheriff was firm. "Harry, you better go peacefully," he said. "You're crazy," snarled the young man. Why arrest me? What's the charge? Murder, said the sheriff coldly. You killed Chiquita Morales. That's a lie. It's the truth, Harry. You've still got that turquoise ring. It's in your pocket. Take it out and deny it. The arrest had sobered Harry Colton. Swearing his innocence, he felt in his pocket and took out the turquoise ring. He took one good look at it and flung it at the back bar. The next moment, the big sheriff had crashed Colton against the bar and deftly handcuffed him. Harry Colton was not swearing nor protesting now. He seemed too stunned to even notice the crowd as the sheriff led him outside. The bartender recovered the ring and gave it to a man to give to the sheriff. Word that Harry Colton had been arrested for the murder of Chiquita, morale spread swiftly. The sheriff was in a quandary as to what to do about Frenchie Arnett. Hashknife got Frenchie aside and explained to him that arrest didn't mean that Harry Colton was guilty. Frenchie laughed, shortly, but promised to keep his trigger finger under control. I think you were wrong, Hashknife, confided the sheriff. Maybe I am, admitted Hashknife, but it'll stir things up. It sure will if a mob decides to lynch Colton. Sleepy showed up, having been on a mission, and reported quietly, Sam, Hack went to tell Thomas Colton, but he's back at the Pasatempo. I heard Colton tell him he'd be right up to the jail. You stay here and keep your eyes open, partner, ordered Hashknife, and went swiftly up the street. Hashknife wasn't sure of anything. When he had dropped that turquoise ring into Harry Colton's pocket, he was acting on a vague sort of hunch, a hunch that this was the time to force the issue. There was a light in the living room of the Colton home. Colton hadn't been to the jail. Hashknife came straight to the house, so it was evident that Thomas Colton was taking his own sweet time in reacting to the arrest of his son. Hashknife circled to the rear of the house, working along a low fence, when he heard a door close quiet. A moment later, someone came toward the fence, climbed over it, and headed south. The man was evidently carrying something, which he lifted over the fence. Hashknife trailed him as close as he dared. The man crossed the street, far from any lights, and walked swiftly down the road which led south from Tomahawk Flats, but he only went a short distance and stopped off the road. A minute later, he was coming back. Hashknife dropped flat as the man went past him, panting a little. He saw him turn into the main street. Hashknife saw the man was not carrying anything when he returned, so he went on in the darkness, just off the road, searching as well as he could in the darkness, and almost fell over a valise which had been left behind a small clump of brush, only a dozen feet off the road. The heavy valise was locked, and Hashknife didn't bother to try and open it. He picked it up and went back to Colton's house, where he left the valise against the low fence. There was a light in the house, but the blinds were down. Hashknife tried the kitchen door and found it unlocked. Quietly, he opened the door and listened, but there was not a sound. He closed the door, moved ahead to the partly open doorway which opened into the living room, stepped aside against the wall, and waited for something to happen. He had been there about 10 minutes when he faintly heard footsteps on the plank walk which led from the street. There was a sharp knock at the front door, and then the door opened. He was unable to see who had come, but heard more than one come in. A voice called, Colton. When there was no reply, he heard a man swear bitterly, damning the Colton family back several generations. Where the devil did he go? He never came to the jail. Ya don't suppose? A voice began. Suppose what? Asked another man. Never mind. Where did Hartley go? I seen Stevens there, but I didn't see that long-legged bloodhound. That damn Trent. He made a mess of the deal. $500 all shot. Never mind the $500, said the other nervously. We've got to find Colton. Don't ya realize that Harry will talk? He ain't got the guts of a cottontail. Let's head south. No, we won't head no place, not till we find Colton. Damn it, we've got to find Colton. Where did that ring come from? That beats me. I threw it away, I tell ya. I heard it hit the buggy. Maybe that fool Harry found it. He's half crazy anyway, he should have been dumped into the canyon with Regan. We'd have been safe, that's a cinch. Regan got what was common to him. Askin, the association to send a man down here to buy ranches, said it'd look legitimate. Legitimate hell, they sent Hashknife Hartley. He found it out and lost his nerve. Scared to write or wire us, came down himself and wanted to get out of the deal. Never mind what happened to Regan, what'll happen to us? Nothing, snapped the man. Maybe we're through here, but we can live. Like kings in Mexico. Yussi, the man stopped short. Hashknife heard the door click shut and Colton, voice saying, keep your hands where they are, both of you. What's eaten you, Colton? Asked one of the men anxiously. What did you two do with that valise? Are you crazy? What valise? Don't lie to me, you got it. I cached it beside the road, got Harry's horse and saddle, and when I got back there, it was gone. I'll give you 10 seconds to tell me where. There was the sound of a scuffle, the thud of a falling body, and a voice drawled, "Just set right there, my fine-feathered friend. Pick up his gun before he gets any bright ideas. Standin' on a loose rug ain't safe, Mr. Colton, not when I've got him toe through a hole in one end of it. All right, all right. This gun's easy on the trigger, my friend. Start tellin' us where you put the money." "Money?" panted Colton, his voice husky. "You fools, I want to know where you put it. Put that gun away." "Listen, I couldn't leave the money here, so I cashed it. Along the road, in a valise, but it's gone, I tell you. Ain't he a cute thing?" queried a voice sarcastically. "Why, you lion, pup, scared somebody'd find it, you was going to pull out with the money and leave us to face the music. I've got a damn good notion to blow your head off, Colton. Maybe I will if you don't." "S-H-H-H-H-H," hissed a voice. "Somebody common. Get in that chair, Colton, guns out of sight." Someone knocked on the door and one of the men said, "Come in." Hashknife heard the door open and a voice said, "Come in, Sheriff, oh, Mr. Stevens, too." Hashknife stepped into the doorway, shoving the door wider. He could see Colton, white-faced, sitting in a chair, looking toward the doorway. He could also see part of one of the other men, and he held a gun behind him and cocked. "Colton, you didn't show up," Nick McGarvin said, and we've got to. "Tell ya, Harry had a gun hidden on him summers, and he shot himself. No, he ain't dead, but he, what's this all about?" "Set down," rasped one of the men. "Keep your hands in sight. All right, Colton, where? That money, our only chance is to get out of here now, and we don't go without that money." "I told you," husked Colton, "that somebody got it, if you two didn't. You ain't lying, Colton. Would I lie now? I'll hold these two. Get your horses, and we head for Mexico." "Broke." "Colton, I don't trust you not a bit. Tell us where that money is, or I'll shoot ya flat. If we can't get the money, why should we bother with you, you sneakin' coyote? Either you get that money and we all go south, or you die here and we pull out together." "He ain't givin' ya much choice, Colton," said Sleepy. "Ya might as well play square with him." "Keep your nose out of this, Stevens," snapped one of the men. "One cinch when we leave here, you won't be on our trail." "Hashknife will," reminded Sleepy calmly. "And if ya ask me, I don't believe you're going any place. Ya see, ya don't know where he is." "Hartley," whispered Colton. "Maybe he followed me in." "I'm getting out," declared a man. "Money be damned, my hide's worth more'n any money." The man wasn't taking any chances with his partners. With his 45, tensed at his hip, he began backing toward the doorway to the kitchen. The door was open just wide enough to let him through, but he didn't make it. A dull thud sounded, just as he was almost out of their sight, and he went right back, head down, shoulders sagging, buckled at the knees, and sprawled flat onto his face, almost into the sheriff. For a moment, it seemed that everyone except Sleepy was off guard. Sleepy shot out of his chair and dived into one of the men, blocking his gun hand, and the force of his dive crashed over the table, knocking the lamp off and plunging the room into darkness. A gun flashed twice, but the spurts of flame went straight toward the ceiling. Hashknife flung, the door wide open, as a man came at top speed, but the tall cowpoke dropped to his knees and the man tripped, going into the air and coming down with a crash against the old kitchen stove. Hashknife was on him like a flash, gathering in the man's two arms. "Light something, will ya?" Sleepy was yelling. "I think this hombre is petrified, but I'd like to be sure." The amazed and excited McGarvin managed to light matches. Sleepy was astride Sam Hack's back, his hands locked behind him, and Sam Hack was having trouble getting enough air. McGarvin quickly handcuffed him. "When ya get a little time on your hands," Hashknife called, "I could use some rope or something. Better find a lamp, Nick, you'll burn your fingers with all the matches." Sleepy came out with a rush, lighting matches while the sheriff found and lighted a lamp. Thomas Colton had struck his head against his own stove and was in no shape to try a getaway. They dragged him into the living room and stood back, panting a little. Gus Staley groaned and sat up, trying to caress his aching head. He peered at the three men, who were looking at him, groaned dismally, and lay down again. Someone had heard the two shots, which knocked shingles off the roof, and in a few moments, plenty of folks were running forward. Sleepy tried to keep them back, but it was no use. Uncle Andy and Ede Frawley were there, Buck Nolan, Frenchie Arnett, and most everybody else who could get in. The sheriff was at a loss as to what to do next, so Hashknife took charge. "Folks, will ya give us room, please? Gus Staley, Gus, do ya know what sayin'?" "To hell with you," groaned Staley. "I don't talk." "If you don't, one of the others will. And the man who talks first gets off easiest. Shall I wait for the others?" Gus Staley, his eyes just a bit off center, looked at the faces around him and decided to talk. He said, "I didn't do it." "All right," said Hashknife. "We'll start from the first, Gus. You and Hack and Harry held up the bank and took all the money." "It wasn't stealing," whined Staley. "Colton planned it. His idea was to break the county and buy it back cheap. and Harry wore that turquoise ring, eh? He bought it from Chiquita and forgot he had it on. You shot Oren Blakely, Gus. That's a lie, husked Staley. Hack killed him. He refused to go in on the deal, got scared and pulled out. Hack was afraid he'd talk. I liked Oren, hell, I wouldn't have done it myself. Why did you kill Chiquita Morales? Hack got scared, whispered Staley. Harry was a fool to wear that ring. Chiquita could have told who had it. Harry wanted to make Chiquita swear that he never had the ring, but Hack said the safest thing was to shut her mouth. I wasn't there, it was Hack and Harry. You can't kill women and have your luck last. Who hired Trent to shoot me tonight, Staley? Colton. He paid him $500. Gus, we know why and how you fellers killed Regan. Wasn't he using the name of James Morrison? Yeah, he was the syndicate, the Yaller pup. Folks, said Hashknife wearily, you've heard the story, I can't tell you anymore. In fact, if Gus hadn't been scared, I couldn't have told you half that much. Uncle Andy and Ede Frawley shoved their way over to the sheriff, and Uncle Andy said, it all came too fast, Nick. Does this mean that Johnny's free? Why, sure he's free. Don't paw me around, go and paw Hashknife. But Hashknife wasn't in sight. He and Sleepy had gone through the crowd and were outside heading for the main street. Uncle Andy went galloping past them, intent only on finding Aunt Judy and Nell Frawley. They paid their bill at the hotel. The old hotel keeper said, some excitement. Hey, I heard there was more trouble down at Tom Colton's home. What happened down there, or don't ya know? That's right, nodded Hashknife, and they walked out, smack into Aunt Judy, Nell Frawley, and Uncle Andy. Uncle Andy grabbed Hashknife by the sleeve and turned him around, while Aunt Judy planted a kiss on his cheek. Not a word had been said until Hashknife said, aw gee. He turned Aunt Judy around, facing the lights of the hotel, and she was crying. I thought that kiss kinda ran a little, he said. When you see Nick, Uncle Andy, you tell him that valise full of money is just outside, Colton's south fence. No, ya don't, whispered Uncle Andy. No, ya don't. Eddie Connors said that you two a lose pull out on folks. You've got your war sacks with ya, but ya ain't going. Nasir, ya ain't. This time ya don't go. Hashknife Hartley, tomorrow night is Christmas Eve and you brought peace to dancin' devil. Johnny's free to marry Nell tomorrow night. We get our money back and you just try to leave here. You won't go, will you? Asked Nell, her voice choked. You can't even think of it, Hashknife, not this time. Well, said Hashknife quietly, I reckon we can stay. Can stay. Snorted Uncle Andy. You'll stay if I have to hogtie ya, you ain't the right size nor the right shape, but if Sandy Klaus ever came to dance in Devil Valley, yo or him. Let's go get Johnny, said Aunt Judy quietly. The sheriff just went down there. Hashknife and Sleepy, still holding to their war bags, stood in the hotel doorway. Frenchie Arnett came past, stopped and looked at them. Sleepy said, how are ya common, Frenchie? I'm all right, replied Frenchie. Everything is all right. Ya see, Chiquita. Sold that ring, she wasn't tradin' it. Yeah, I reckon it's all right. Frenchie went on. Sleepy said, well, ya can't run away from everything. Maybe they'll make you best man. But tell me something, tall feller, how'd you manage to suspect Tom Colton? Remember the first time he talked with me, Sleepy? He had a telegram from James Morrison who turned out to be Regan, after we took this job. Regan didn't have time to get a letter about us, and the telegram didn't mention who we were. But Colton said, after all, the cattlemen's association wouldn't recommend a man who wasn't capable. How would he know who recommended us unless he had another wire ahead of the one I read? That wasn't much to go on, said Sleepy. It was enough, smiled Hashknife. Maybe I better send a telegram to Bob Marsh and tell him the ranches ain't for sale. Yeah, that's a good idea, partner, and when ya write it, give him my regards, will ya? They grinned at each other, went back and registered again. Transcriber's note. This story appeared in the October 25, 1948 issue of Short Stories magazine. End of the project GUTNBRGEBOOK Dancing Devil Range asterisk. Updated editions will replace the previous one. The old editions will be renamed. Creating the works from print editions not protected by U.S. copyright. Law means that no one owns a United States copyright in these works, so the Foundation and you can copy and distribute it in the United States without permission and without paying copyright royalties. Special rules set forth in the General Terms of Use part of this license apply to copying and distributing project Gutenberg trademark electronic works to protect the project GUTMBRGTM. Concept and trademark. Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark and may not be used if you charge for an ebook, except by following the terms of the trademark license, including paying royalties for use of the Project Gutenberg trademark. If you do not charge anything for copies of this ebook, complying with the trademark license is very easy. You may use this ebook for nearly any purpose, such as creation of derivative works, reports, performances, and research project. Gutenberg ebooks may be modified and printed and given away. You may do practically anything in the United States with ebooks not protected by U.S. copyright law. Redistribution is subject to the trademark license, especially commercial redistribution. Start full license, the full project GUTMBRGTM license. Please read this before you distribute or use this work to protect the Project Gutenberg trademark mission of promoting the free distribution of electronic works by using or distributing this work or any other work associated in any way with the phrase Project Gutenberg. You agree to comply with all the terms of the full Project Gutenberg license available with this file or online at www.gutenberg.org/license. Section 1. General Terms of Use and Redistributing Project Gutenberg Electronic Works. 1A. By reading or using any part of this Project Gutenberg electronic work, you indicate that you have read, understand, agree to, and accept all the terms of this license and intellectual property trademark copyright agreement. If you do not agree to abide by all the terms of this agreement, you must cease using and return or destroy all copies of Project Gutenberg electronic works in your possession. If you paid a fee for obtaining a copy of or access to a Project Gutenberg electronic work and you do not agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement, you may obtain a refund from the person or entity to whom you paid the fee as set forth in paragraph 1E8(1B). Project Gutenberg is a registered trademark. It may only be used on or associated in any way with an electronic work by people who agree to be bound by the terms of this agreement. There are a few things that you can do with most Project Gutenberg electronic works, even without complying with the full terms of this agreement. See paragraph 1C below. There are a lot of things you can do with Project Gutenberg electronic works if you follow the terms of this agreement and help preserve free future access to Project Gutenberg electronic works. See paragraph 1E below, 1C. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the Foundation, or PGLAF, owns a compilation copyright in the collection of Project Gutenberg electronic works. Nearly all the individual works in the collection are in the public domain in the United States. If an individual work is unprotected by copyright law in the United States and you are located in the United States, we do not claim a right to prevent you from copying, distributing, performing, displaying, or creating derivative works based on the work as long as all references to Project Gutenberg are removed. Of course, we hope that you will support the Project Gutenberg mission of promoting free access to electronic works by freely sharing Project Gutenberg works in compliance with the terms of this agreement for keeping the Project Gutenberg name associated with the work. You can easily comply with the terms of this agreement by keeping this work in the same format with its attached full Project Gutenberg license when you share it without charge with others. 1D. The copyright laws of the place where you are located also govern what you can do with this work. Copyright laws in most countries are in a constant state of change. If you are outside the United States, check the laws of your country in addition to the terms of this agreement before downloading, copying, displaying, performing, distributing, or creating derivative works based on this work or any other Project Gutenberg work. The Foundation makes no representations concerning the copyright status of any work in any country other than the United States. 1E. Unless you have removed all references to Project Gutenberg. 1E1. The following sentence with active links to or other immediate access to the full Project Gutenberg license must appear prominently whenever any copy of a Project Gutenberg work, any work, on which the phrase Project Gutenberg appears or with which the phrase Project Gutenberg is associated, is accessed, displayed, performed, viewed, copied, or distributed. This ebook is for the use of anyone anywhere in the United States and most other parts of the world at no cost and with almost no restrictions whatsoever. You may copy it, give it away, or reuse it under the terms of the Project Gutenberg trademark license included with this ebook or online at www.gutenberg.org. If you are not located in the United States, you will have to check the laws of the country where you are located before using this ebook. 1E2. If an individual Project Gutenberg electronic work is derived from texts not protected by U.S. copyright law, does not contain a notice indicating that it is posted with permission of the copyright holder, the work can be copied and distributed to anyone in the United States without paying any fees or charges. If you are redistributing or providing access to a work with the phrase project Gutenberg associated with or appearing on the work, you must comply either with the requirements of paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 or obtain permission for the use of the work and the project Gutenberg trademark as set forth in paragraphs 1E8 or 1E9. 1. E3. If an individual project Gutenberg electronic work is posted, with the permission of the copyright holder, your use and distribution must comply with both paragraphs 1E1 through 1E7 and any additional terms imposed by the copyright holder. Additional terms will be linked to the project Gutenberg license for all works posted with the permission of the copyright holder found at the beginning of this work. 1. E4. Do not unlink or detach or remove the full project Gutenberg license terms from this work or any files containing a part of this work or any other work associated with project Gutenberg. 1. E5. Do not copy, display, perform, distribute, or redistribute this electronic work or any part of this electronic work without prominently displaying the sentence set forth in paragraph 1E1 with active links or immediate access to the full terms of the project Gutenberg license. 1E6. You may convert to and distribute this work in any binary, compressed, marked up, non-proprietary or proprietary form, including any word processing or hypertext form. However, if you provide access to or distribute copies of a project Gutenberg work in a format other than plain vanilla ASCII or other format used in the official version posted on the official project Gutenberg website, www.gutenberg.org, you must at no additional cost, fee, or expense to the user provide a copy, a means of exporting a copy, or a means of obtaining a copy upon request of the work in its original plain vanilla ASCII or other form. Any alternate format must include the full project Gutenberg license as specified in paragraph 1E1, 1, E7. Do not charge a fee for access to, viewing, displaying, performing, copying, or distributing any project Gutenberg works, unless you comply with paragraph 1E8 or 1E9, 1, E8. You may charge a reasonable fee for copies of or providing access to or distributing project Gutenberg electronic works, provided that you pay a royalty fee of 20% of the gross profits you derive from the use of project Gutenberg works calculated using the method you already use to calculate your applicable taxes. The fee is owed to the owner of the project Gutenberg trademark, but he has agreed to donate royalties under this paragraph to the project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Royalty payments must be paid within 60 days following each date on which you prepare or are legally required to prepare your periodic tax returns. Royalty payments should be clearly marked as such and sent to the project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation at the address specified in Section 4, Information about Donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. You provide a full refund of any money paid by a user who notifies you in writing or by email within 30 days of receipt that s/he does not agree to the terms of the full Project Gutenberg trademark license. You must require such a user to return or destroy all copies of the works possessed in a physical medium and discontinue all use of and all access to other copies of Project Gutenberg trademark works. You provide, in accordance with paragraph 1F3, a full refund of any money paid for a work or a replacement copy if a defect in the electronic work is discovered and reported to you within 90 days of receipt of the work. You comply with all other terms of this agreement for free distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark works. 1. E9. If you wish to charge a fee or distribute a project Gutenberg trademark electronic work or group of works on different terms than are set forth in this agreement, you must obtain permission in writing from the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the manager of the Project Gutenberg trademark. Contact the foundation as set forth in Section 3 below. 1F1F1. Project Gutenberg volunteers and employees expend considerable effort to identify, do copyright research on, transcribe, and proofread works not protected by U.S. copyright law in creating the Project Gutenberg trademark collection. Despite these efforts, Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works and the medium on which they may be stored may contain defects, such as, but not limited to, incomplete, inaccurate, or corrupt data, transcription errors, a copyright, or other. Intellectual property infringement, a defective or damaged disk or other medium, a computer virus or computer codes that damage or cannot be read by your equipment. 1F2. Limited warranty disclaimer of DMAGS, except for the right of replacement or refund described in paragraph 1F3, the project. Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, the owner of the project. Gutenberg Trademark, and any other party distributing a project. Gutenberg Trademark Electronic Work under this agreement, disclaim all. Liability to you for damages, costs, and expenses, including legal fees. You agree that you have no remedies for negligence, strict. Liability, breach of warranty or breach of contract except those, provided in paragraph 1F3. You agree that the foundation, THE, trademark owner, and any distributor under this agreement will not be liable to you for actual, direct, indirect, consequential, punitive or incidental damages even if you give notice of the possibility of such damage. 1F3. Limited right of replacement or refund. If you discover a defect in this electronic work within 90 days of receiving it, you can receive a refund of the money, if any, you paid for it by sending a written explanation to the person you received the work from. If you receive the work on a physical medium, you must return the medium with your written explanation. The person or entity that provided you with the defective work may elect to provide a replacement copy in lieu of a refund. If you receive the work electronically, the person or entity providing it to you may choose to give you a second opportunity to receive the work electronically in lieu of a refund. If the second copy is also defective, you may demand a refund in writing, without further opportunities to fix the problem. 1F4. Except for the limited right of replacement or refund set forth in paragraph 1F3, this work is provided to you as is, with no other warranties of any kind, express or implied, including but not limited to warranties of MERC chantibility or fitness for any purpose. 1F5. Some states do not allow disclaimers of certain implied warranties or the exclusion or limitation of certain types of damages. If any disclaimer or limitation set forth in this agreement violates the law of the state applicable to this agreement, the agreement shall be interpreted to make the maximum disclaimer or limitation permitted by the applicable state law. The invalidity or unenforceability of any provision of this agreement shall not void the remaining provisions. 1F6. Indemnity. You agree to indemnify and hold the foundation, the trademark owner, any agent or employee of the foundation, anyone providing copies of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works in accordance with this agreement, and any volunteers associated with the production, promotion, and distribution of Project Gutenberg trademark electronic works, harmless from all liability, costs, and expenses, including legal fees, that arise directly or indirectly from any of the following which you do or cause to occur: a distribution of this or any Project Gutenberg work, b. alteration, modification, or additions or deletions to any Project Gutenberg work, and c. any defect you cause. Section 2. Information about the mission of Project Gutenberg. Project Gutenberg is synonymous with the free distribution of electronic works in formats readable by the widest variety of computers, including obsolete, old, middle-aged, and new computers. It exists because of the efforts of hundreds of volunteers and donations from people in all walks of life. Volunteers and financial support to provide volunteers with the assistance they need are critical to reaching Project Gutenberg goals and ensuring that the Project Gutenberg collection will remain freely available for generations to come. In 2001, the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation was created to provide a secure and permanent future for Project Gutenberg and future generations. To learn more about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation and how your efforts and donations can help, see Sections 3 and 4 and the Foundation Information page at www.gutenberg.org, Section 3. Information about the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. The Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation is a nonprofit 501(c)(3) educational corporation organized under the laws of the state of Mississippi and granted tax-exempt status by the Internal Revenue Service. The foundation's EIN, or federal tax identification Number is 64622-1541. Contributions to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation are tax deductible to the full extent permitted by U.S. federal laws and your state's laws. The foundation's business office is located at 41 Watchung Plaza 516, Montclair NJ 7042, USA, plus 1-862-621-9288. Email contact links and up. To date contact information can be found at the foundation's website, an official page at www.gutenberg.org/contact, section 4. Information about donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation. Project Gutenberg trademark depends upon and cannot survive without widespread public support and donations to carry out its mission of increasing the number of public domain and licensed works that can be freely distributed in machine-readable form accessible by the widest array of equipment, including outdated equipment. Many small donations, $1 to $5,000, are particularly important to maintaining tax-exempt status with the IRS. The foundation is committed to complying with the laws regulating charities and charitable donations in all 50 states of the United States. Compliance requirements are not uniform, and it takes a considerable effort, much paperwork, and many fees to meet and keep up with these requirements. We do not solicit donations in locations where we have not received written confirmation of compliance. To send donations or determine the status of compliance for any particular state, visit www.gutenberg.org/donate. While we cannot and do not solicit contributions from states where we have not met the solicitation requirements, we know of no prohibition against accepting unsolicited donations from donors in such states who approach us with offers to donate. International donations are gratefully accepted, but we cannot make any statements concerning tax treatment of donations received from outside the United States. U.S. laws alone swamp our small staff. Please check the Project Gutenberg web pages for current donation methods and addresses. Donations are accepted in a number of other ways, including checks, online payments, and credit card donations. To donate, please visit www.gutenberg.org/donate, section 5. General information about Project Gutenberg electronic works. Professor Michael S. Hart was the originator of the Project Gutenberg concept of a library of electronic works that could be freely shared with anyone. For 40 years, he produced and distributed Project Gutenberg ebooks with only a loose network of volunteer support. Project Gutenberg ebooks are often created from several printed editions, all of which are confirmed as not protected by copyright in the U.S. unless a copyright notice is included. Thus, we do not necessarily keep ebooks in compliance with any particular paper edition. Most people start at our website, which has the main PG search facility, www.gutenberg.org. This website includes information about Project Gutenberg, including how to make donations to the Project Gutenberg Literary Archive Foundation, how to help produce our new ebooks, and how to subscribe to our email newsletter to hear about new ebooks.